This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeline Bourne.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, let us make men, from golems to androids. This week, we're looking at created life from myth and legend all the way up to the latest offerings in sci-fi. And there's been quite a lot of them recently.
Again, you might have noticed by the difference in the recording, Jules and I are actually in the same room again.
Yep, it does happen.
This is our writing week, second edition, rather the Dorset edition. We're going to apologise and forewarn you now. We're on very squeaky leather sofas, so if you hear lots of squeaking, be assured it's not a distressed mouse, it is just us chipping round.
Yeah, it's not like bad person.
We're telling you it isn't. So, topic today, it was actually Jules' idea to do this one, so I'm going to let her start, because,
I've been reading a book called The Golem and the Djinn, and it's an interesting look at, basically, from Middle Eastern Hebrew tales, you've obviously got the djinn from sort of a Siberian type background, and the golem from Hebrew tales. Yep. In Hebrew tales, the golem is a creature made of clay. It's a beast of burden that's about 20 times as strong as your average man and is bonded to one specific master who can give it commands. You'll find in all those tales that at some point the golem will go on a rampage and has to be destroyed. It causes a lot of damage before it does. In this book, the golem has been made female and given intelligence and curiosity and basically her master wakes her up and then literally dies of appendicitis about half an hour later, and she's left alone, basically a newborn in a fully adult body with more intelligence and the strength of 20 men, and she lands the next day in Ellis Island in New York. And the book is about her journey to sort of discover what she really is. And I can't tell you how it ends because I don't actually know yet. I haven't got there. But I thought it was an interesting look at how something that's created ultimately only really belongs to itself, and that creations that are not allowed to belong to themselves tend to turn on their creators, which you find in lots of myths and legends.
It's interesting as well because it's almost an inverse Frankenstein, in that obviously Frankenstein, it was about him trying to recreate a human and ultimately creating something which did not look human. And in this case, it's about something which is not human that looks human and has to live as a human, even though intrinsically she realizes that she's not.
No, and her difficulties are she doesn't need to eat, she doesn't need to sleep, but she feels constantly this, because her master died, the one who would have given her purpose by giving her commands. Now she feels a slight pull to obey everybody's desires, and she can feel what everybody wants. And it's very difficult for her to constantly concentrate on not just responding to someone's desires, to actually be her own creature. But she has a very, very strong moral compass, which is completely opposite to the djinn, who's been imprisoned in a vase, and it is just really interesting how she goes about it. And she is getting to the stage where she could quite easily go on a rampage and start just destroying everything, because traditionally in Hebrew folk stories, a golem would either at the death of their master, or their master would word something badly, very much as you would word something badly to a djinn, actually, because a djinn is also a slave right up until the moment. And it's the same thing. And there's something quite horrible about this idea of creating something that might be sentient but has no choice but to obey you. You're creating a slave.
Yeah.
There's something Terry Pratchett covered in Peter Clay as well, where the golems eventually find a sort of freedom. They're not free from their own natures, and their own natures are to have a purpose. but they get a sort of freedom in the sense of deciding who they're going to obey.
Yeah.
And they end up sort of supplementing the law enforcement, actually, because what they're really good at is following sort of a set of parameters. They understand that, no, this is bad. And you find it in some of the later books with Maurice von Lipwig, who's a con artist and one of Terry Pratchett's best characters, in my opinion. And he's not a bad person, he just doesn't think about the consequences of his actions. And they get him to behave in going postal by putting a golem on him. And the golem follows him around, protects him, and also says that he can't do that with Lipwig. Is that because that would be immoral? Every time Moist tries to run away, they go and fetch him back again.
I think this topic really opens up, and it opens up this question that we need to ask ourselves, which goes back to the original concept that Christian and Jewish and Muslim, and in fact, in quite a lot of origin stories of man, the concept was that man was created in the image of God. And over the years, that we start to question what it is that means. And actually, in a lot of the literature and things that we create, where man does something similar and creates something new within its own image, the actual issue in that story isn't actually about what these things that we create look like. It's the fact that when we create them in our image, we also create this sense of identity. And it's about actually the ability to understand right from wrong, the ability to self-rationalize, and that actually seems to be the reoccurring thing. So the concept is that it's not actually about how we look, it's about our ability to be individuals, basically. And very often we get a lot of, you know, post-apocalyptic stories where you have, we create robots or androids and we try to make them as human as possible. And in doing so, we trigger something which then basically allows them to start thinking for themselves, which is the ultimate human thing to do. And at this point, they're superior to us. So they start deciding that we are a threat.
And that is an interesting, that's a really interesting point, is the idea that obviously if you go back to the creation myth of Adam and Eve, and they were given free run of the Garden of Eden, except for the tree of the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil. And of that tree thou shalt not eat the fruit.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, if you don't want them to do it, why did you put it there? Give them curiosity and intelligence and the ability to reason. And in some ways it's sort of a fable about the unconscious mind becoming conscious of itself. And, you know, deciding to choose how to act, whether to be moral or amoral, I suppose. Good and evil is not really the right way to say it.
I'm just going to, sorry, go on a slight tangent there, just with the whole Adam and Eve thing and thou shalt not eat the tree. Someone saw a post which made an interesting observation, which is that actually Adam was the one who was told thou shalt not eat from the tree. And Adam then told Eve that they were not supposed to eat from the tree. But the order was never actually given to Eve, which is why she eats the fruit first. And then she gives it to Adam, and only after she gives it to Adam they say they realise that they're naked. Which makes me think that actually Eve could have totally gotten away with it. It was Adam who wasn't supposed to eat it.
Yeah, and I think that's where certainly Jungian philosophy is a case of Eve is supposed to represent the unconscious mind.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, Adam being the conscious mind, you're not supposed to consciously look at your actions in that way, which to me doesn't really hold water.
No. And it's a very interesting thing, because there's so many layers to the question, and there's so many layers about our fascination with our own image. And clearly the fact that, you know, if you, whether or not you believe in God, if you believe in God, then you believe and believe that we are created in his image, then you believe that our image is one of a godliness. And vice versa, even if you don't, you know, if you don't actually believe in God, if God doesn't exist, then humans decided that our image was of a godly nature. And so then, that there's a real sense of arrogance and superiority there. And then you kind of touch in with this sense of human loneliness, where it gets to the point where it's not satisfying enough to just have children or anything like that. Humans want to create something which is like them, basically. And I guess we start to sort of go, we go into the uncanny territory a little bit there, because very often what happens is that they create something which is like them, but they kind of fail in it.
Yeah. And it's enough apart that there's something quite disturbing or disconcerting about it.
Yeah.
Before we go sort of into, you know, android, mechanoid, robot territory,
yeah.
I talk about, just a completely different myth, which is the Welsh legend from the Mabinogion of Glwdebeth, which is the story of the woman made of flowers.
Mm.
And it was a sorcerer called Clwclaw Chris who fashioned for himself a woman
of
flowers.
No, I'm sorry, I need you to say that again.
Clwclaw Chris, who he took the flowers of oak, the flowers of ash, and the flowers of broom, and made a woman for himself. But this woman, once she's made, doesn't love him. She doesn't want him. Nobody's ever asked her who she wants. And he's made her conscious. And she falls in love with another man who's not a sorcerer, called Grom, and has an affair. And her husband finds out, isn't terribly happy about it. And they have this, well, a rather bizarre duel where they fling spears at each other. And Gron says, well, hang on a minute, you're a sorcerer. So after he flings his spear and completely misses Clwclaw Chris. And so Gron says, no, hang on a minute, you're a sorcerer. Let me put something between you and me. And he puts a stone, a large boulder, between himself and the sorcerer. So the sorcerer flings his spear and it drills a hole right through the rock and kills him. And the stone afterwards is then called the Stone of Grom. And it stands in one of the Welsh valleys near where he used to university. Never actually seen it. But it's one of those whole stones and they tend to then become sort of holy sacred sites.
Mm.
But the bit that always got me was he then turns around to Glwdebeth and says, you know, accursed art thou, because you know, you betrayed me, and he turns her into an owl so that she will always be alone. And so whenever you hear the owl crying, it's a woman crying out her loneliness for having betrayed her husband.
Well, that's merry.
But once again, you've got somebody creating something in their own image, effectively, and then expecting it to behave as a slave. And as you made the point earlier, it's our ability to make choices and reason that actually raises us to that level where, you know, where we can make abstract deductions and inductions.
Again, and sorry, this makes me go back to the Adam and Eve mythos, which is that, you know, we've mentioned before, Eve wasn't the first woman. The first woman was actually Lilith. And Lilith was created similarly to Adam. She was created out of Earth. And I think it's rather telling that Eve was then created out of a part of Adam. And so she wasn't just created in the image of God, she was created out of man. And she was subservient in that respect. She was subservient. She did what Adam wanted her to do. And I guess, I think the image, the message of all of these mythologies is women should do as they're told, which is not great. That women were created for the, you know, the plunder of men, and that they don't do as they're told, they get punished. It's a fun time.
Certainly the idea of subservience or a created creature being a slave in some way, and their creator being horribly surprised when they turn out to have a mind of their own, even though that's how they've been designed.
Mm.
I mean, even if you take something which is, I've always found it quite sinister actually, but it's a lot more innocent than any of these stories, which is the story of Pinocchio.
Yeah.
A man wants a son, so he creates a puppet out of wood. The puppet's brought to life. The puppet doesn't immediately recognise him as a father.
No.
And act like a human child. In fact, we're supposed to think he acts very badly because he's very much not human. And he can't earn his humanity until he learns to be obedient. But you can't expect him to be anything else because he's suddenly, you know, created with the ability to be self-directing. And people, well, you see it with toddlers, they're at the stage where they're trying to push boundaries and do things they're not really supposed to do, even if there's a really good reason to tell them not to do it.
Well, it's this new initiative you see, especially with parents talking about their children and saying that don't make your children hug people if they don't want to hug people. Don't make your children, like, I understand saying, no, don't stick your fingers in the plug, you know, and don't sort of try and crawl into the oven. There are reasons why we sometimes tell children not to do certain things. At the same time, however, I've never really agreed to the whole sort of, well, you're my child, so you have to do as I say because I'm the reason you're alive. And it's just, there has to be a level of responsibility where if you've decided to create a life, whether in the biological sense or within the create a golem, you do not control that life. That life does not belong to you. But you are responsible for it because you created it. And I think that as we move onward into an era where we no longer see children as objects, really, we start to see even more stories which are looking at the rebellion of objects against us.
Yeah. I mean, we've been re-watching Battlestar Galactica, the reboot, not the old one. But basically, the whole underpinning premise of that is the Cylons, which were extremely... Well, no, the Cylons, which were basically androids created to help serve the needs of humans, have rebelled, and an accord was reached whereby they stayed on their planet and everybody else stayed on theirs, and we never heard from them again. The thing is that the Cylons don't die, and they haven't forgotten, and they're not happy about the fact that they've been repressed. And they've got to the point where they can now look like us. To the point when we can't tell the difference, we wouldn't know. And very much like all the myths where, say Perseus or some of the other great heroes, where they go on a quest and end up actually acting against the interest of their gods and creators, the Cylons destroyed all the human colonies in an attempt to completely make humans extinct.
Yeah.
And they make a point during one of the episodes where they say, we are their children, really. We are killing their parents. And another Cylon says, but that is the purpose of children, to supplant their parents. And it is a case of, well, yeah, in a way, we've made something. We've decided not to be responsible for it. We oppressed it, and you know what? It's not happy anymore. But we've also made it a lot more capable than we are.
And it's also it addresses the idea that we cannot be grateful for something creating us.
No.
That being grateful for something does not mean that, you know, even if you say, well, I'm glad to be alive, I'm glad that you raised me, I'm glad all of that, but that doesn't mean that, that there's ownership or anything along those lines. And I wonder whether it doesn't all of it stem from angsty children who grew up to make the same mistake. No, you know what, that's not what I mean, but it also ties into this fear of progression that we get, where it's that, you know, when you're young, go along with progression, and then after a certain point in time, you stop being able to catch up, and you start to fear all of the changes. And I think my favorite thing is, you know, people saying, oh, this technology, people using that, you know, computers all the time, they don't know how to write. And then you go back and it goes, they're school teachers saying, oh, these people using paper, they don't even know how to write, you know, on chalkboards and stuff like that. And it just, that's how it is. And that's how it's always been. You reach a certain age, and unless you make an effort to continue pushing forward, you become bitter. And I think in some ways that ties in with it a little bit.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Obviously Battlestar Galactica goes on a bit of a journey with what exactly does divide the humans and Cylons? Because there isn't an awful lot, ultimately.
No.
I mean, one's very much created and the other's, you know, born. But aside from that, I think ultimately they sort of find that there's more similarities than there are differences. Because the Cylons start to fracture and have, you know, subsects that believe one thing, others that believe something different. Some are more sympathetic towards humans. And it's an interesting exploration of what exactly makes you human. Is it the ability to be self-directing? Is it what you do with that knowledge? Or is it quite purely a matter of biology whereby you have to be born?
Hmm. Now, I have a question for you. Have you ever read one of these stories where a human has created something new and that new thing has rebelled? Have you ever read a story where the new things are the ones that win? Or do humans always, or either peace is attained between the two or humans come out on top?
Yeah, I think by and large that is the case.
So again, we have that sense of superiority.
But I mean, I think I might have read a couple of short stories where but you know, they were very, very bleak. So it's really what sort of tone the writer was trying to evoke as well.
Mm.
And they tend to be quite cautionary.
Yeah.
To go back to Frankenstein here, but I wouldn't say that that was a massively successful ending for either creature or Frankenstein.
But again, Frankenstein is something very different. Frankenstein is a story about something that is not, not human trying to be human, but wants to be human. I mean, it was designed to be human. Whereas, rather it was meant to be human and then it turned out not to be human. And then it couldn't understand why it wasn't human because inside it was human.
Yeah.
It just didn't look it. Also Victor Frankenstein made some bad choices.
But yeah, he did take responsibility for his creation.
Yeah, he didn't take responsibility.
At the point where it was most important to do so.
And it really does stem the whole thing. It's that the abandonment and the lack of responsibility. It's either a lack of taking responsibility of the thing you create, or regarding it as a thing of for your convenience and your pleasure, rather than thinking of it as a sentient thing that you have yourself created, and that you can nurture, but that you can't ultimately control.
Yeah. A quite good example of that, I don't know if you've watched any Westworld.
I've avoided it like the plague.
It's very, very good. It's also utterly horrible on a lot of levels. And the idea for anybody, it's from an old Michael Crichton novel, which I haven't read and haven't actually heard of, so there you go. And it's a reboot of the original film, I think.
Yeah.
But the series is probably a bit more morally dubious in a lot of ways. And it's a theme park that's basically set in, you know, the Wild West, as romanticised and seen as a sort of fantasy type area.
Mm.
And people go in, and the hosts, as they're called, are effectively robots. And robots, very much in the case of robot coming from an old word that actually means slave, which is what robot really means. It doesn't mean a mechanoid person, it's just that that's what it's applied to, quite aptly, because they tend to be slaves as well. And they look human, but they are programmed to respond in certain ways. it programs basically give you a come on of some kind to get you to integrate with this world, to make it a fantastic business venture.
Yeah.
And something's going wrong with the programming. They're trying to make them more and more human all the time. And with that comes just a tiny twitch of being able to self-direct or to think, this shouldn't be happening to me.
Yeah.
Because they program them with responses like fear and happiness, and they pair them up together. And they found pretty soon after they made this amusement park that what people wanted to do was not go in and have a Wild West adventure. What people wanted to do was go in and abdicate all responsibility for their actions and do horrific things to people, well, to the creatures who looked like people, you know, without having to take any responsibility for their actions at all.
Yeah.
You had people going in and just being able to sleep with these robots because they can't say no. They're programmed to, very much like the Golem, they're programmed to respond to your desires.
Yeah.
And they'll shoot them as well. And some of them will do it on the smallest limb because they just cannot see them as being at all living. Of course, the problem is that being quite sophisticated computers, they remember all this. They're not supposed to be able to access that memory. But as their programming changes, they start being able to access the fact that they've been perhaps murdered hundreds of times before in hundreds of different ways, and that other abuses have been traced on them. So again, we're very much looking at exactly what makes us human and what doesn't. Who's the most human in that scenario? Who's the most humane?
Yeah.
So it's very well written. It's extremely good. It's very, very disturbing.
And it also begs the question of how we treat things that we see as human.
Yeah.
And how we treat things that we see as they're like us, or if we don't see them like them. Now, we look at Frankenstein again. The blind man who couldn't see a creature treated him like a human.
Yeah.
The people who could see the creature and therefore didn't consider him human treated him abysmally. The people treat the golem badly because they know it is not human, but they don't consider the fact that actually it can think for itself, at least within a certain degree. And again, that raises questions also about how we treat animals, how we treat machines,
how we treat people of different races.
How we treat people of different races. And we go back to the whole to slavery, and the fact that we said they are like us, but they are different from us, and therefore they are not as, they're not as sophisticated as us, they are not as godly as us, therefore we can treat them in this way because they don't feel the same things as us.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, they're less sophisticated. They don't think, they don't feel, or if they do, it's less complicated, it matters less.
Yeah.
I mean, there's another program called The Humans, which the second series, I think, has started now.
Yeah, and it's based on a...
That's based on the novel.
Well, it's not actually that old. It's based on another TV series, and I think it's either Norwegian?
Yeah, that's right.
Which is even more sophisticated, and the sort of the European one is a bit kind of dumbed down, actually. At the same time, it's being pretty well received.
Yeah, and again, you've got a situation whereby it's sort of like a little helper in your house, but it looks human, except that some of them really do would pass the Turing test, whereby, and the Turing test, very, very briefly, if you don't know, is where AI has reached a level whereby you could not distinguish that it was not a human that you were reasoning with. And at that point, you can't actually distinguish between the two.
You know, there is actually a way of cheating it. By replying, I don't know. if you technically you reply, I don't know, then you can actually still beat the Turing, and it's like, I don't know.
I suppose the thing is that if it was a robot or a mechanism of some kind that was programmed to respond, then it would try and respond with what it needed to be factually correct. So
yeah.
Unless you programmed it to say, I don't know, to all questions. But yeah, with the humans. And then, again, I found it so intensely disturbing that there was additional software called the adult package that came with it. And that when you install this software, you're basically turning this very attractive, glorified housekeeper into, well, I suppose a pleasure bot as well.
Yeah. It makes me think of a manga I read a while ago like that, called Chobits. And this was a while ago, but Chobits, the idea was that they were computers, basically, and you could use them literally as your laptop or something along those lines. You know, they had uses like make a reminder, be an alarm, things like that. But they were almost, they looked like humans, but they tended to have small little features which made them distinguishable from humans. So like ears or you know, special kind of animal ears and things like that. And they were everywhere. And there was one story about this, a woman who really didn't like them. The story was that they got a Chobit, a computer, for their home. And the husband just really, really loved this computer. And he just basically forgot about his wife one day. He just sort of kicked her out because actually he had got everything he wanted from this computer who just did whatever he wanted. And the premise of the story is it's about actually one of these computers which is created, which can actually feel love. And can actually have emotions. And there's a complicated element to it, which is that her reset button is between her legs, basically. And so actually, the idea is that if you build a relationship with her, if you try to actually, you know, use her in that way, she resets. So she'll forget everything. So it's the question of, do you value her as a person in order to keep these memories, or are you going to use her as a sex bot? And if you use her as a sex bot, if you put all of the importance on that, then she will just be forever a computer that cannot develop any further simply because she keeps being reset. And there was more to it than that. I never managed to finish reading it, but it was an incredibly complicated story. And it really did look at the different ways, and I think another one, which is not something we've looked at, which is a boy who makes these computers, and he created one to replace his sister who died. And he put all of her memories in there, and all of her sort of reactions so that she would respond in the same way. And this computer, even though she isn't capable of feeling, is programmed to be able to think, and this computer manages to express the fact that she doesn't like the fact that she can't actually help him, because at the end of the day she only knows what to say, but as in that she can't actually do anything because she's aware of the fact that she's not actually the sister.
Yeah.
And it was very interesting. And you know, it's we aren't going in that direction. We're going in that direction.
Have you ever seen AI film? Not a happy film, really, but there's a couple have a son who I think he goes missing, and there's some sort of problem where they can't have children, or can't have more children. So what they do is they pretty much get an off-the-shelf son, a little boy. He's always going to be a little boy. Which I find that intensely disturbing.
Yeah.
And then a miracle happens, and she's expecting another child. And so they don't want him anymore. And so they get someone to drive him out to a dump in the middle of somewhere and get rid of him. And he spends the rest of the film trying to get back to his parents. He is programmed to believe they're his parents, and that they love him, and that he loves them, and that everything will be right when they get back together.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks at his journey a little bit as he gradually, I mean, there are other androids as well. There are say Jude Law playing a male prostitute, but he sort of takes him under his wing. It, again, interesting film, quite disturbing. It's sort of a retelling of Pinocchio. Again.
Yeah.
But I find that, you know, the idea that you have something that you're responsible for and keeping it permanently in the state of childhood sort of goes to another level for me as well.
But also the fact that you can, again, it's that idea that it's the second best thing. And when the best thing comes along, the real child comes along, this android that they've created, that they've raised, that up until that point they've invested in, is no longer significant because it's lesser.
Yeah.
It's just the replacement. And the idea that we create things as replacements. I think we go back into the past of people who would, you know, who would have labour jobs, who would have children, so that they could help out, basically, on the farm or on the, you know, where they, and it, there was a practical sense to that as well. You know, we have children, I want children so that they can help out.
Yeah. Well, also, if you're going to have children, this was certainly something that happened in Ireland a lot, where you had, my gran was one of 14 children.
Yeah.
And this was not just being part of a Catholic family. Your children were your retirement.
Yeah.
There was no pension scheme. So you had children so that some of them would survive to adulthood to be able to look after you when you got old.
Yeah.
Was part of it. I'm sure that sort of contraception being illegal was a big issue too.
Yeah, that probably also helped in the matter. So again, we have that whole issue of we create things, but we see them as lesser.
But I do wonder, and being just European, certainly with children being our creation as well,
Well, I think we're not allowed, because society now has developed to a point where we're not really socially allowed to think of other human beings as lesser.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, do we romanticise what might be just a practical biological function, which is having children?
Yeah. No,
I don't necessarily think so. Because looking at, I don't know if you saw it, we actually went out the other day and we had to wander around a church that I used to visit as a child, and there was a tablet inside that I hadn't really read before, but it was dated 1717.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a big solid piece of marble that had been really beautifully carved, and it was to commemorate the death of the son of a well-to-do lady and husband of the area, and it was to commemorate a child who died at 5 years old. And that was at a time when perhaps children weren't considered little bundles of joy.
No, I think, I don't think so, because I think even on a biological level, you know, we are designed to procreate. And again, that's not saying that all people should be procreating, don't get me wrong. If you don't want to have children, then, you know, I'm sure David Attenborough would shake your hand. so would I, you know, great, we're really overpopulated on ourselves. But there are hormones and biological things in place which mean that, which has basically prevented the human race dying out, even though childbirth is horrible. You know, sex, if you really think about it, is pretty awful. And if it wasn't, what was it, that line in the house, which is that, sex is messy and awful, and if it wasn't so damn fun, we would have died out years ago. And so, yeah, I think that there is a reason we haven't gone extinct as a species, and that is that having children is an intrinsic part of what we are. That being said, there is an element, again, of this over that we probably need to address. We need to understand why of this fact that of superiority, which is that we as a species do see ourselves as superior, and because of that, perhaps we put too much importance on ourselves and our offspring. And of course, again, it went back that, you know, not even 100 years ago, we saw some white people saw themselves as more superior than black people or people of colour. We saw ourselves, our children were more important than the children of someone of African descent or whatever, basically. And now we're no longer, well, I say we don't, I'm not going to say we don't think that, because there are still people out there in the world who do, but we're not, it's no longer socially really acceptable to think that anyone, that anyone ethnicity or that anyone skin colour is superior. And so we're kind of turning, we've had slaves taken away from us. But humans instinctively like to find the easy way out. We like to find things that can do our work for us. So we can't have slaves anymore. So we create slaves. And again, we apply that, well, it's lesser than me, so therefore I don't need to worry about it. And as we get into more territory where our hubris basically says, okay, but we want to create things that are like us, we're going to need to start really asking ourselves, can we therefore treat these things, can we therefore treat machines still as slaves if we are at the same time trying to make them human?
Yeah. I think that's a good point. And why exactly? Why the intense desire to create effectively machines that, you know, ape humanity to the point where we can actually fool ourselves? Why the Turing test?
Why indeed? I think it comes from an element of because I can. No, I think it does. I think we're fascinated. You know, just as we're fascinated, we want to have children. I think there's a little bit of that leaking into it as well. We want to take it to the next step where it's not even just about having children. Because actually, you know, things you're like, yeah, I want to have children, and then you have a child and you're like, well, this thing is going to be really boring for, you know, 18 years. No, you know what I mean, boring is the right word, but as in, like, you have a child and it can't really do very much for quite a long period of time. And so it's that to create something which is immediately on the same level as you. I think there's an element of that. There's an element of hubris as well. I think some people do it for quite, you know, honest, they have honest intentions when they do it. And I think in other respects, some people do it because, again, they want to create something that we can, have sex with, basically. Yeah, well, I'm sorry.
That seems to be where everyone's going. Okay, how I feel about this is that it doesn't matter whether it's sentient or not. If you create something that is a glorified sex toy that will respond to your desires, how you want, have whatever you want, I find that incredibly creepy. I really do.
Yeah, and I think that, but we do it. We do it. And it's about what's in demand and what's, you know, because we're no longer at a stage where people get married because they have to, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
No longer, we're at a stage where people need to find their own kind of releases. It's no longer guaranteed. There's so many of us. Lots of people now go into the world lonely, you know? So there's a market for, to fill that kind of gap. And to have something that doesn't say no to you, that doesn't say no to you no matter what kind of person you are, first of all, it's a real problem because it means that people stop questioning about the hang on a second, why is no one into me? Is it honestly because I've got, you know, is it because I'm ugly or is it because I'm a terrible person and I'm, you know, pretending not to be? And so that kind of the no, everyone deserves it mentality, everyone deserves to get it on mentality, has kind of birthed this creation of sex toys. And the fact that, yeah, you don't need consent from it. But at the same time, I think the reason we're trying more and more and more to make sex toys realistic and real, again, comes down to the uncanny. We are not comfortable with things that are not quite human. And so you get this sense of, yeah, it looks sort of, it looks like me, but I can't be comfortable with it because there's something still not right about it. So we're trying more and more and more to make it even more human. And in our attempt to make these sex toys even more human, what are we actually creating? And actually, should we be doing that?
Yeah. It just makes me think there are two episodes of Buffy in particular. One of them is called I Was Made to Love You. And it's Warren, who becomes a bit more of a villain later on. He starts off just being a bit of a lonely nerd, and he makes himself a girlfriend. Quite literally makes himself a realistic girlfriend. But she wouldn't have passed the Turing test. She can't reason for herself. She does what she's programmed to do.
Yeah.
But it's horrible, because then he meets somebody who is different, who fights with him all the time, but who pushes him and challenges him and really properly calls for her.
Yeah.
And instead of taking responsibility for his creation, he just leaves the room and tells her to wait and never comes back for her. Which, like the golem, sends her on a bit of a rampage because she goes looking for him.
Yeah.
And then this gets harked back to a bit later on when Spike just cannot get Buffy to come round to the idea of them being together. So he has Warren create a Buffy bot for him. Which, on one level, is really gross, but on the other level, you think, well, actually, that is exactly what Spike would do, because that he doesn't see anything wrong with that.
Yeah.
But again, the substitute is not as good, because
it's
programmed to give you everything you want, and something that's programmed to give you everything you want
can't actually
satisfy you at all.
Yeah, something that's programmed to give you everything you want may not necessarily give you everything you need, ultimately. But that makes me think again, it makes me think two things. First is an episode of Gravity Falls, so I'll get back to that one. Second one is another manga I read a very long time ago, so I'm probably going to get this all wrong, called Absolute Boyfriend, where this girl is, again, quite innocent. She sort of accidentally ends up ordering an android boyfriend online. And he arrives at the door, and he's amazing. He's amazing. And we don't actually know how much of it's programming and how much actually he is sentient. All we know is that there's a timer aspect to him, which is at the end of the day, he is still a robot of some kind. And he is amazing, and you know, she kind of does fall in love with him. But at the same time, she's got her best friend, who's another guy as well. And he's that human presence. And it's about her, you know, it's a coming-of-age story for her and sort of finding who she is and also finding love for the first time. And ultimately, actually, she ends up with her best friend, who she's supposed to be with. And the kind of the android sort of puts her in that position to do it, because ultimately he knows he can't actually be with her. And in the end, I think he deactivates, basically. That's what happens, is that he's only going to work for a certain amount of time, because he's only built to be able to give that much. And I did wonder how they were going to end it, because either he was going to have to become sentient to the point of it was going to be okay, but then he would never have aged. He would have never, he wasn't human, he wasn't right for her, and his entire purpose, actually, in the end, was to be what she needed in order to grow.
Yeah.
As a person, as a girl, and then ultimately help her be the friend she needed to help her find her own way. And so I quite like that. I might actually go back and reread it. I might have remembered it entirely wrong. But the other one is Gravity Falls, where Zeus wants to get a girlfriend, and he gets a game, which is a dating game. Get those. So that he can sort of practice, and actually, obviously, he finds it very easy to be on the dating game, because if he gets something wrong, he can just undo it. And then he tries to apply it in the real world, and of course it doesn't work. And there's this famous line where he says something to this woman, and he just goes, oh, hey, undo, undo, and she looks and she goes, you cannot undo. or something. Like, you cannot undo your mistakes or something like that. And he's like, oh, it was actually really kind of actually frightening. Yeah. And then in the end, he stops trying and obviously he meets this girl. But what happens is that he then completely forgets about his online, this game girlfriend that he has, who then obviously goes on rampage because she's super possessive of him and the game is haunted. So, on the one level, it's played on jokes that actually at the end of the day, this online girlfriend was still absolutely bonkers crazy. But then again, there's that element of, well, he didn't realise that she was sentient. But then again, we have to ask ourselves, is that enough of an excuse to say it's not sentient? Because he just turned her off. Just turned her off. And it's not like, I guess, he couldn't end it. It was just a game. And again, we look at it on a real sense and say, no, it's not sentient. We know it's not sentient. It's a game. But that mentality goes back again to slavery, where, no, they're not sentient. They're not.
I think that's where I have a bit of, I have difficulty, is because we, as a species, made assumptions about sentience. And we've been proved wrong quite a few times. I mean, we don't know how our ancestors, the Cro-Magnons, totally interacted with, say, the Neanderthals, the Homo erectus, or the Devonians. But they're made quite naturally, in a biological sense, in a sense of superiority, because they were all competing for the same niche, the same resources.
Yeah.
And when you have two species competing for a niche, one will be successful and one won't be, and that's evolution.
Then you had to ask yourself, how much of it is taught by society? Because when we're little, and I still get guilty about my teddy bears, you know?
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. I mean, I was also thinking about the other great apes, so orangutans and gorillas and chimpanzees. I'm not going to have chimpanzees and pets. I think that's, again, the uncanniness, the fact that they're kind of us, but they're not.
Yeah.
At the same time. And it has been shown that if you teach them to communicate the way that we can understand, they can actually master abstracts. So, I mean, they taught gorillas and chimpanzees how to sign.
Yeah.
And orangutans. And they had quite a few of them saying that you'd say to one of them, what are you thinking? And another, it would reply with, I'm thinking about having something to eat. That's not, I'm hungry.
Yeah.
That's not expressing a desire like a child. That's, I'm thinking about the future and
yeah.
considering eating in the future. That sort of mastering of abstract, the ability to deduct and induct, it's like, well, that's sentience.
Yeah.
So we've been experimenting in your species in labs to find, you know, cosmetics, worst case scenario. And really, it's not the case that you're another species of human, but you're perhaps a less advanced technologically species of sentience.
And then again, we have to ask ourselves, why the sentience, why do we class sentience as the thing which allows us to act in certain ways? You know, we can say, and this is it, I'm not a vegetarian, I am a meat eater. Mm. But there is an argument that could be said that just because we act differently to a sheep, does that mean that we have the right to eat it? But then again, we ask ourselves, what is the right? If we look at nature, it's a simple fact of the food chain, you know. But then again, we have to look and say, but we're no longer governed by those rules. We are not living in that kind of society. We've created a social construct which actually means we don't need to be meat eaters in order to survive. I mean, some people, and again, this is not me plugging a sort of a vegan or vegetarian sort of thing. I am a meat eater. Meat eater? I am a meat eater. I enjoy eating meat. I'm not going to stop. And I also know several people, several of my friends who went to vegetarianism for ethological reasons, and had to stop because of problems with their health. So there is a biological element as well, but we can get around it. It is possible to get around it, and it's definitely possible for us to eat less meat.
Yeah.
And for us not to treat the meat that we do eat as appallingly as we do. And yet, we kind of let it slide. Some people, obviously, there are people who don't let it slide. But we do kind of, as a species, we let it slide because we differentiate and say they are not the same as us. Again, it's all about that superiority. We are more important than these animals because they do not display the same kind of understanding or the same kind of thought cognizance as we do.
And it seems to come down to those pillars, doesn't it? It comes down to what we perceive as sentience and the ability of a creature of any kind to impress us with that sentience by communicating in a way that we recognise as actual communication.
But then the thing is that even animals that we do recognise that, dolphins and things like that, we hold them in captivity. And we use them, and even when they display behaviour that says we are clearly unhappy, we're literally trying to commit suicide. We don't consider that, and it's only actually in recent, we've had this recent push against orcas and whales. There are certain animals that do okay in captivity. There are certain animals that actually thrive in captivity. Pandas thrive in captivity. Well, I say thrive, you know what I mean. There are certain animals which are okay in captivity, and there are certain animals which are not designed for captivity at all. And we as human beings can actually recognise that. We have specialists who say, look at this behaviour we know, and yet we persist.
Yeah, I agree, but I have to say, if you look at our history over the last few thousand years of capturing rival tribes of any kind and then enslaving them, and how we treated people through slavery or even subjugating women or subjugating people who just don't follow the rights of religion or whatever, I'm not surprised.
No,
I would like to be, but I'm not.
No, and I think that what's happening is that as we progress and say, no, that is no longer acceptable, it's not that those kinds of feelings disappear, it's that we apply them to something new.
Yeah.
And I think now we're applying them to machinery. And at the moment, we can argue that that doesn't actually matter, because most machinery does not feel. We haven't applied it to actually have a sensory kind of nervous system. But as we advance more and more, we're going to have to ask ourselves, actually, we're going to have to expand those parameters and ask ourselves, again, what is it to be human? And what are we programming? And why the hell are we programming it like this on purpose?
Yeah. I mean, what do you think of the Uncanny Valley type stuff, where it is pretty close to, you'd have to do a double take, kind of. You can tell it's not human, but...
Yeah.
The first glance, your gaze might just skitter over it and then you're on there.
Well, I think the whole thing is that, it skitters over, but it'll trigger something in the mind that goes, hold on.
I don't recognize that.
Yeah, there is something which is unfamiliar to this pattern. Which I think, in some ways, actually, is probably what happened when two people of different skin colour met each other for the first time and both did a double take, I think there was an element of the uncanny there as well, which is that this looks like something I expect, but doesn't actually look, like a black man seeing a white man for the first time. Well, it's like blue eyes appeared only actually quite recently in human history. Can you imagine the first time someone appeared with blue eyes and everyone else going, well, that's weird?
Well, I think the first instance is, you try and defend yourself, and the second instance apparently is to try and mate with it, because you're expanding the gene pool.
Yeah.
It's quite depressing when it comes down to that.
Yeah. The uncanny thing, I'm really unsettled by the uncanny. Everyone is to a certain degree, but I am quite unsettled by the uncanny. And things with me, it's proportions. Proportions are the things that get me.
Yeah.
And it's odd. Sometimes some things I get away with, but my old housemate, I think we're gonna have to finish up on this. It's just a little funny story. My old housemate, after I had been doing a particularly intensive afternoon of research and to fairies. There we go, brought it in. I've been doing a particularly intensive afternoon research for fairies, the not-so-pleasant things that were happening. And of course, there's a lot of uncanniness that appears in deities and fairies and etc. in things that are just not quite human. And that, the next morning, that evening, it got even weird. That evening, I was disturbed by a sound in the middle of the night, which I didn't know what it was. It was this odd kind of pinging sort of noise, and it wasn't a phone. I had no idea what it was. And normally when that kind of thing happens in the flat, my immediate response is to get up and go and have a look what it is, because I'm in charge of the flat, so if there's something wrong, I need to address it very quickly. But as I made to get out of bed, this sudden unsettling thought, again, because of all the research I've been doing, sudden unsettling thought fell over me, which was that, nope, you don't want to know what it is. You don't want to know what it is. You don't want to see it. This is not something you should see. Get back to bed, close your eyes, go back to sleep. And usually when I think something creepy is going on, that's me. I'm awake for the rest of forever. But I just I just followed my own instructions, but okay, got back into bed, rolled over and went straight to sleep. Like, nope, I'm forcing myself to sleep. And it wasn't even relaxed. It was very tense. And the next morning, my partner, Sean, got up for me. And he was in the sitting room. And I came in and I looked at him, up at him. And I'd made a little fairy door just for the fun of it. And I put it up against the wall. And there was this tin foil humanoid climbing up toward the door, and it had really elongated limbs, and this head. And so it was humanoid, but it had the very long limbs, which just gets to me. I hate that. And I looked at Sean and I said, "That's really funny, you know, ha ha ha." You know, I was not happy. And he looked at me and he said, "I thought you did that. I was sitting in here with my back to it because it freaks me out." I was just like, "You didn't make it." And so I was stood there like panicking until I, you know, stood there and I shouted at my housemate. She came and she was like, "Oh yeah, yeah, that was me. I just, you know, thought it'd be funny." I said, "I never want to see this thing again. Okay, I don't want to see anything like this again." And of course, she made another one and had it hanging from my door handle. So I was not happy, but yeah, it was the. It was the inhuman proportions, which is sometimes you get inhuman proportions which manage to look cute, you know, like chibis and stuff like that, where they manage to sort of make it work. And, you know, you look at anime proportions and they tend to be pretty incorrect. And there are some things we can get away with, but elongated limbs is not one of them.
Elongated fingers,
elongated neck. There are certain things that we kind of draw the line at, and I think the things that we sort of accept are the things that we tend to consider to be beautiful. So things such as large eyes. But again, you can kind of get away with it in cartoon form, but if you see, it's like so often people try to sort of make human versions of cartoons, and the moment it starts to look human is the moment you kind of go, no, that's terrifying, because those things, it then starts to draw on that uncanny element. Yeah. Anyway, I think that's all we have time for.
Yep, it is. So, this week, looking at our fascination with creating things in our own image, and at what point we have to admit they belong to themselves and not their creators anymore.
Mm-hmm. I feel very sophisticated. It's a very deep topic. I'm sitting here and it's fire down. Jules had tea, but
that's still sophisticated.
It is, no, it's very sophisticated. It warned her that I got steadily more drunk, she wasn't doing that. But yeah, tune in with us next week. We hope you've enjoyed.
Thanks for coming.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page
at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.